following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
Today we are looking at probably one of the most famous stories from the entire Bible. And it's so famous because it forms kind of an archetype. I mean, we all love the underdog, right? And this story has an underdog who's standing up to the big bully, and against all odds, he wins. And who wouldn't fall in love with a story like that, right? We love to cheer for the underdog. And that means even though some people have never even opened a Bible, they will catch the reference if you mention David and Goliath. And that story, that confrontation, is found in 1 Samuel chapter 17. I encourage you to have your Bible opened up to that. It's a long chapter. We're going to dip in and out of it and work our way through it. Because you see, for people of faith, this story is more than just inspiring. It actually teaches us how to face giants in our own lives. Because sooner or later, we will all face challenges that are bigger than we are. You believe it? We all face challenges that are bigger than we are. And as this story opens up in 1 Samuel 17, we see the nation of Israel facing a huge challenge from a people known as the Philistines. In verse 1, now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Socoh, which belongs to Judah, and they camped between Socoh and Azekah at Ephes Damim. Now, in our day, the word Philistine is often used as a synonym for barbarism or uncivilized. But in the 11th century BC, when this story took place, the Philistines were anything but barbarous and uncivilized. If anything, they were the most technologically advanced peoples in the whole Levant at that time. They were more experienced as seafarers, they were more sophisticated in their commerce, and they were by far more advanced in their technology of warfare than either the Canaanites or the Israelites. And we don't know exactly where the Philistines came from, but we do know for sure they were not native to Canaan. The Philistines were the descendants of a seafaring people who had settled in what is now known as the Gaza Strip around the 13th century BC. Isn't that interesting how all this connects, right? In fact, the city of Gaza itself was one of five cities that the Philistines controlled there in that coastal area. Now, the last few years, a growing number of scholars have been playing around with a very interesting theory that these Philistines may have somehow been connected to the Mycenaean Greeks. For those of you who don't know, there was not just one ancient Greek super civilization, there were two. There was the earlier version, the Mycenaean Greeks, who flourished around the 15th century BC. And then sometime in the 14th century, that civilization all of a sudden collapsed. And it's a few hundred years later, you had the rise of the classical Greek civilization that most of us are familiar with Athens and Sparta and those places. And so some of the scholars think these Philistines may have been connected to those Mycenaeans who scattered when their civilization fell, because that's about the time they showed up in Palestine. In fact, 1,000 years later, the Romans named this whole region Palestia, or Palestine, from the name Philistine. That's where that comes from. What we can say for sure is that these Philistines were a major threat to the Israelites from the time of what we call the Judges all the way down to the story that we're looking at today. So a period of about 200 to 300 years, they were the arch villain in the Israelite story. And these particular Philistines had encroached in the land, which is in verse 1, we see belonged to Judah. They moved into Judah's territory. Judah was one of the tribes of Israel, like a state, if you will. And the Philistines had moved in, they'd camped out, and they were daring the Israelites to do something about it. Make us move. Go ahead. And so King Saul called out Israel's soldiers and rode out to meet the Philistine incursion. In verse 2, Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side while Israel stood on the mountain on the other with a valley between them. Now, I've actually been to Elah. I've seen it. I looked for some pictures to bring, but I couldn't find one that I thought did it justice. But if you can imagine this broad plain, and on one side there's a hill sloping up, And that's where the Philistines camped out. And the other side, there was another hill that sloped up. That's where the Israelites camped out. And then in the middle of this huge plain, there's a creek bed running right through the middle of it. And who knows, maybe that's the same creek that plays a big part of the story a little later on. I've actually stood in that creek bed and imagine what it must have been like 3,000 years ago to have been there when this confrontation took place. The Philistines were camped out there and waiting for the Israelites. And every day, we read the Philistines would send out a champion to challenge the Israelites to trial by single combat. In verse 4, we read, "Then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath." That was another city they controlled, "whose height was 6 cubits and a span." And jump down to verse 8. "He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, 'Why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine and you servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we'll become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us.' Again, the Philistine said, 'I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together.'" Now, the Hebrew word translated as champion in verse 4 literally means a man between. And this was not the typical practice among Middle Eastern cultures to have this kind of representative combat. But it was something that we read about in Greek literature. The idea was, instead of these two armies clashing together, which would result in a massive casualties, each army would pick a representative to fight on their behalf, winner take all. And the man the Philistines sent out as their champion was both physically and psychologically intimidating. As we read, his name was Goliath. In Hebrew, that means to exile or to expose. And in this case, Goliath was exposing the weakness of the Israelites. Rumor associates Goliath with a Hebrew legend about a race of giants who lived in the Philistine territory. And Goliath's appearance did not do anything to dispel those rumors. Now, at this point, I got to be honest with you, and I used to think this was a big liberal thing, but it's not. It's actually in the text. There's a discrepancy in some of the ancient copies that we have of the Old Testament. And some, like the Septuagint, which is the first Greek translation of the Old Testament from Hebrew, or the Dead Sea Scrolls, or in the writings of the Jewish historian Josephus, who lived right after Jesus lived, they describe Goliath as being around 7 feet tall. Most modern translations rely on other copies of the Old Testament in Hebrew, and those list him as being 6 cubits and a span, which if you do the math and try to work that out to an equivalent in English, it's about 9 feet tall, okay? Now, we shouldn't dismiss that number out of hand. A lot of people read, 9 feet tall? No way! I mean, some of y'all think Brother Tom is 9 feet tall. He's closer to 7 feet. But Goliath, 9 feet tall? No way! Oh, hold on. The world record for the world's tallest man is held by, he's actually passed away now, his name was Robert Wadlow, and he was documented in 1940 at the time of his death of being 8 feet 11 inches. There's a guy living in Turkey right now named Sultan Kassin, who is measured just shy of 8 feet 3 inches. There are certain conditions that, you know, make it where people don't stop growing, and so these individuals who have this condition reach much greater height than some of the rest of us. And whether Goliath was 7 feet or 9 feet tall, it really doesn't matter. The point's the same. He was an abnormally huge, scary dude. Especially when you consider the average height back then was shorter than me. And Goliath's armaments are dramatically described like something out of a Homeric legend, okay? In verse 5, he had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. He also had bronze greaves, that's armor, on his legs, and a bronze javelin swung between his shoulders. That's actually probably a type of sword swung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and the head of his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. That's about 15 to 20 pounds. His shield carrier also walked before him. This guy's armor was so big, he actually had to have a guy carrying his shield for him. He couldn't carry the shield and all the other stuff too. This is the only place in the Bible where a person's weaponry and armor is described in so much detail. And I think the point is to drive home, this guy is a monster. In fact, his scale male shirt would have weighed 125 pounds all by itself. So just to move around in that, he's got to be a hoss. Today, video gamers would describe him as a tank. I mean, this is not a guy you want to run into. And this is the guy the Philistines are sending out to fight for them. And so he taunted the Israelites daily. He would come out every morning for 40 days. Can you imagine going through over a month of this? And the word here that where he says in verse 10, I defy the ranks of Israel. Literally, that word means I insult you. Okay? He is out here trash talking the Israelites every day for 40 days. And nobody's willing to do anything about it. His appearance and his taunting paralyzed the Israelite army. Verse 11, when Saul and all Israel heard the words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Nobody on the Israelite side was willing to take him up on his challenge. And think about this. King Saul's mentioned by name. You know why? Because he was the most likely guy to challenge Goliath. Do you remember when one of the reasons Saul was selected as king in the first place? Back in 1 Samuel chapter 9? Because he was larger than life from his shoulders and up. He was taller than all the people. And Goliath made him look short. Who or what is your Goliath today? What's the giant standing in your path? As you seek to follow God's path for your life, what's standing in your way? What obstacle or challenge are you staring at that makes you want to run away and hide instead of moving forward in faith? What Goliath is exposing your weakness for all the world to see? That's the giant you got to get past before you can move forward and realize the purpose God has for you. We face giants in all shapes and sizes. Sometimes it's a giant of illness. We get a diagnosis that shakes us to our core. Sometimes it's failure. We've messed up. We've made a mistake. Or we tried to do something that was big and it flopped. And it's hard to come back from that. Sometimes it's financial challenges. We get in over our heads and we say, there's no way I can ever catch up. There's no way I can ever pay off this debt. Maybe it's addiction. It's really hard to break through that on your own. There are all kinds of giants that people face in their lives that block their path and taunt them and dare them. Hey, you just try to get past me and make us feel so small. David's story actually offers some suggestions to help us face the giants that are intimidating and bullying us. Here's the first one. Let your faith in God be bigger than your fear of the giant. Let your faith in God be bigger than your fear of the giant. So after Goliath's dramatic introduction, we find out that David had some brothers who were fighting there at Elah with Saul and his army. Verses 12 through 14. Now David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse. We were introduced to him in the last chapter. And he had 8 sons. And Jesse was old in the days of Saul, advanced in years among men. The 3 older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul to the battle. And the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn. Remember, he's the one that Samuel was just sure, that's the one that God's going to pick to replace Saul. And God said, nope, not him. He had the 2nd was Abinadab, and the 3rd, Shema. David was the youngest. Now the 3 oldest followed Saul. David has these brothers that are serving with Saul's army. And you may say, wait a minute, we ended chapter 16 with David serving as Saul's armor bearer and his personal musical therapist. Why isn't he there with him? Go back to chapter 16, verse 21 for just a second. We don't know how much time there is between then David came to Saul and attended him, and on the other hand, Saul loved him greatly and he became his armor bearer, okay? We read that and we think, oh, that all happened all together. But there could be an interval of time in there where that was a process. David had to do some things that impressed Saul enough to make him his armor bearer. And then we get to chapter 17, verse 15, and we read this. David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's flock at Bethlehem. So apparently, the chronicler is trying to pull together 2 different sources, 2 different records, and reconcile them. And he tells us that for a time, David split his time between his duties with Saul and his duties on the family farm in Bethlehem. So he is back in Bethlehem with his father tending the sheep. And his father sends him, in verse 17, to the front to check on his brothers. And while he's there, David has a chance to hear Goliath's challenge. Verse 22, then David left his baggage in the care of the baggage keeper and ran to the battle line and entered in order to greet his brothers. And as he was talking with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines, and he spoke these same words, and David heard them. So David witnessed the fearful response from the rest of the Israelites. From the king on down, they were petrified. Verse 24, when all the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him, and they were greatly afraid. And not even the offer of a priceless reward could convince anybody on the Israelite side to stand up to this giant. Verse 25, the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who's coming up? Surely he's coming up to defy Israel. And it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. What he means there, there's going to be a cash reward. Hey, if somebody would go fight this Philistine, Saul's going to give him a cash reward. He's going to give his daughter to him. That means he's going to be married into the royal family. Think about how that would change your life. And he says his family's going to be free. They're going to be exempt from taxes. Hey, how would you like to be exempt from taxes? Where's the giant at? But not even that could convince anybody to go face Goliath. And here's David, 15-year-old shepherd boy, straight off the farm, and he hears all this, and he saw the giant's taunts for what they were, a taunt not just against Israel, but against Israel's God. In verse 26, and David spoke to the men who were standing by him and said, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away this reproach from Israel? You know, this stain from Israel. Get this, for who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God? Two things David says that are really important. He calls him uncircumcised. That's not really an insult. That's just recognizing the fact this Philistine is a pagan. He is from outside the special covenant relationship that Israel has with God, the one they made at Mount Sinai under Moses. You know, where God says, you're my people now, and I'll be your God. Hey, he is not one of us. He's from outside. We are special. We've got this relationship with the one true God. He picked us out to be his special people. Why are we letting this uncircumcised pagan push us around? And the second thing he talked about, he says, why is he taunting the armies of the living God? Who did Israel really belong to? They belonged to God Almighty. He's the one that had freed them from slavery in Egypt. He'd brought them across the desert. He'd given them his word. He'd made this covenant with them. They belong to him, and yet they are running in fear from a pagan. And David's beside himself. David understood that Goliath's continued threats were an attack upon Israel's covenant and the God who made that covenant, the one true God. And every day that Goliath lived to threaten Israel, God was being robbed of glory that rightfully belonged to him. See, the giants in our lives, when they intimidate us and they bully us and they keep us from following God's path for us, they are robbing God of his glory. Because when God helps us overcome the giants in our lives, who is it that receives the praise and the worship and the credit? It's God. God's the giant killer, not us. But when God is able to fulfill his purpose and his plan in our lives, he brings glory to himself. When people see what he's done in our lives, they look to him and say, wow, how can I get in on that? David revered God more than he feared Goliath. And therefore, David volunteered to confront the giant. Verse 31. When the words which David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul, and he sent for him. Saul's finally going, hey man, finally somebody dumb enough to take me up on this offer. Maybe we can do something to get rid of this Philistine. And David said to Saul, let no one's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. King, I'll do it. You know the rest of you are man enough to do it? I'll do it. It's a 15-year-old kid. He's not a soldier. He's a shepherd. But he trusted God. He said, I'll do it. When you decide to confront a giant. It doesn't matter how small you are. That's the point. God is bigger than any Goliath you will face. And the true power is in Him, not you, to begin with. Remember what God has done for you in the past. That's the second lesson from David. Remember what God has done for you in the past. Saul pointed out David's obvious deficiencies. Saul said to David, "You're not able to go out against this Philistine to fight with him. You're but a youth. He's been a warrior from his youth." So he recognized Goliath's a grown man. His whole life he's been training for war. "David, you're a teenager. You're not a soldier. You're a shepherd. You don't stand a chance." David responded by remembering occasions in the past when God had helped him overcome challenges. Verse 34, David said to Saul, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him." Now, as a shepherd, he had protected his flock from predators with little more than his bare hands and a shepherd's staff. There's not a lot of lions and bears left in Israel. Well, back then, they were a problem. And yet, David stood up for him. How many shepherds would have just written off one of those lambs and said, well, we'll take that loss and move on? What did David do? He chased it down. It's like they didn't know he wasn't supposed to just let that thing go, right? David's determination to pursue and rescue those sheep tells us something about his character, doesn't it? It tells us something about his faith in God. Just as God had helped him in the past, David believed God would help him face a giant who was robbing God of his glory. In verse 37, David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And so Saul said to David, "Go and may the Lord be with you." Years later, when God allowed David to unite Israel's tribes into one kingdom, to actually sit on the throne, he wrote a stirring psalm describing that experience and expressing his thankfulness to God for everything that God had brought him to it. Psalm 18, if you've never read it, I encourage you to read it sometime soon. But in verse 29 of Psalm 18, David says this, "For by you I can run upon a troop, and by my God I can leap over a wall." Who was the real power behind David? David wasn't trusting in his own strength to take on the giant. He was trusting in God's. How's God shown up to your life in the past? What obstacles has he helped you overcome? What predators has he protected you from? When we trust in God to help us in these small challenges, guess what happens? Our faith is strengthened. And so we're prepared to lean on God even more during the bigger challenges. Remember what God's done for you in the past. And then, number three, rely on God's resources instead of the world's. Verse 38, "So Saul clothed David with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head and clothed him with armor. David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk, for he'd not tested them." So Saul tried to prepare David for the battle by clothing him in his own armor. Now think about this for a second. I don't think Saul was actually trying to be nice here, okay? Whose armor was this? Whose clothes were these? Saul's. So when David goes wearing all this stuff out onto the battlefield and people are looking from a distance, hey, who's that going against Goliath? Who are they going to think it is? Saul. "I get this guy to go fight my battle for me, and if he, by some miracle, wins, I'll get the credit." At least that's what I'm thinking here. But David refused to wear Saul's armor into battle. He said in verse 34, "I can't go with these. I've not tested them. I'm not used to these, king. I can't wear this." So David took them off. He took his stick in his hand and he chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook. And he put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had in his pouch. And his sling was in his hand and he approached the Philistine. Now, you got to understand, a lot of times we think about, 5 smooth stones. We're thinking little bitty rocks, right? No, they would look, and sometimes they would actually make these. They would chisel out rocks to fit this. Think about a stone the size of a tennis ball. Okay? First of all, you got to be pretty strong to fling something like that. But a lot of these ancient, they called them peltasts, were incredible marksmen. I mean, they could split a hair with those slingshots. And he's going to sling a stone probably about the size of your fist toward this giant. He's got a bag full of these. But that's all he's taken out against this giant of a man. Too often we set out to fight the world's battles with the world's weapons. And let me tell you, it doesn't always work against the giants. Our ultimate hope should be in God's power and in God's tools. We'll go out and we'll try to fix things. You know, there's an old saying, might makes right, you know? The end justifies the means. So we'll set out to follow that philosophy, and God says, no, that's not right. I resist the proud. I bless the humble. It's like Jesus when he said, turn the other cheek. Most people say, why? They're just going to knock off that side too. But Jesus says, no. Turn the other cheek. Forgive. But Jesus, that doesn't make any sense. Trust me. See, we have to do things God's way. Not necessarily the way the rest of the world does it. And that's what David put his hope in. Our ultimate hope should be in God's power and God's tools. Another psalm David wrote, Psalm 20, verse 7, says this, some boast in chariots and some in horses, but we will boast in the name of the Lord our God. The prophet Zechariah, chapter 4, verse 6, not by might, not by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. When you go out to face your giant, that doesn't mean we can't learn things from the methods of the world, but we don't need to rely on those things, okay? We need to step out in faith and trust in God's power. A lot of times people ask me to pray for them, and I pray, not only do I pray for people who are sick, I pray for their doctors. Lord, give these doctors the wisdom they need to treat this illness, because, you know, God works through doctors too sometimes. But I also include this, Lord, where human medicine reaches its limits, let your divine power take over. Because I don't want just human medicine working on me. I want the power of God also working on me. Right? We set out to do something and maybe there's a big cost involved or some obstacle that we're facing as a church. And we say, there's no way we can afford to do this. There's no way. We don't have the resources to do this because we're walking by sight. We're not walking in faith. If we really believe God's led us to do something, then we'll find a way because God will provide a way. Amen? We can't go just by what the balance sheet says always. Now, we got to be good stewards. We don't want to be reckless. We don't want to be foolish. We're warned to, you know, count the cost. But part of counting the cost is, you know, you got to include God in the equation. And so we walk in faith. We proceed in faith. David is proceeding in faith that when he needs the strength, God's going to provide it. And instead of wearing armor, he goes out equipped with the tools of a simple shepherd, and he trusts in God to supply the rest. He took his staff. He took these stones. However, the greatest weapon David armed himself with was his faith in Almighty God. It's the greatest weapon in his arsenal. So David set out to approach the giant. Now, this is an important step, okay? Because often when we face a giant, we're tempted to run or hide, right? If we want to experience God's victory, we've got to face that giant head on. We've got to own up to it. We've got to start moving towards it and say, okay, I'm going to trust God's going to get me through this. Realize this. This is God's battle, not just yours. As David approached Goliath, the Philistine did a couple of things. Read verses 41 through 44. Then the Philistine came out and approached David with a shield bearer in front of him. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him. For he's but a youth and ruddy with a handsome appearance. He's a pretty boy. This giant warrior is looking at this 15-year-old kid coming toward him, and he is just guffawing. He is having a belly laugh. Is this the best they can do? He's just a kid. The Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? He saw the shepherd's staff. Apparently, he didn't see the slingshot. The Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine also said to David, come to me. I'll give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field. You're dog meat, son. Let's get it on. Now, David met the giant's taunts with a declaration of faith in God's power. Verse 45, David said to the Philistine, you come at me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin. I come to you, not with a shepherd's staff. I come to you, not with a slingshot and five smooth stones. What does he say? I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. And I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that David is a cool dude, right? That David is bad. Nope. All the world will know that there's a God in Israel. Who was David going to give the credit to? God. And then all the assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. David predicted he would win, but not with his own prowess. Instead, he determined that everybody should know it was really God who deserved all the credit. And note the multiple times here, if you're reading that, note the multiple times that he refers to the Lord, and it's all in capital letters. Okay, you notice that? I didn't count it, but there's several times where he mentions the Lord, but it's all in capital letters. If I told you before, that's a little translator's trick to let you know that what's being translated here is the personal name of God. The name that God gave Moses at the burning bush. The name that God wants to be known by basically means I am, or I'm the one who is. In other words, I am the only true God. That's what the name points us to. And David wanted to make sure that it's that God that's going to deliver you into my hands. Listen, if you're a child of God and you're seeking to follow his path, you can face an obstacle knowing that he is with you and will never abandon you. Yeah, it may be a tough fight, but he's not going to leave you there twisting in the wind. When Jesus gave the church the Great Commission that we recite every Sunday, he sent them out to make disciples. He reminded them that through his resurrection, God had demonstrated Jesus was operating with all the authority of heaven and earth. And what does he promise? Behold, I am with you always. If we're fulfilling what God has given us to do, he is going to be right there with us. Hebrews 13:5. The writer tells us, make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I forsake you. This was written to a group of believers who were under persecution. They were being tempted to recant their faith. Some of them were saying, well, if I had enough money in the bank, I could maybe weather this out. And the writer of Hebrews says, no, don't trust in your bank account. Trust in God. Because he says, I will never leave you, nor will I forsake you. In David's case, the battle was over almost before it began. After 48 verses of buildup to this encounter, the actual fight is described in one verse. Verse 49. David put his hand into his bag, took from it a stone, and slung it, and struck the Philistine on his forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead so that he fell down on his face to the ground. Man, if people had paid to get into this fight, they're probably going to ask for their money back. That's it. Goliath starts to charge. David slings a stone. The rock strikes Goliath in the forehead. Down he goes into the dust. And then we're told David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, with the implication being that it was really God behind David's victories. Because you remember when this little dialogue he was having with Goliath beforehand? The writer, in verse 50, he stresses, there was no sword in David's hand. Why is that important? Because back in 47, we're told the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's. He will give you into my hands. See, who was it that had the sword? It was Goliath. David says, I don't need a sword. I got God. The victory that God gave to David inspired others to face their fears. In verse 52, the men of Israel and Judah rose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the slain Philistines lay along the way to Sharam, even to Gath and Ekron. So there was a rout. Everybody else saw Goliath go down and they said, hey, maybe we can win this battle after all. And listen, when we are able to face our giants and God wins a victory through us, it not only encourages us, it encourages other people who are watching us. And God gets the glory. Finally, when God brings down one giant, get ready for the next round. David took at least two preparations or two actions that were future focused here, okay? First in verse 51. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head. And when the Philistines saw it, their champion was dead, they fled. And then you jump down to verse 54. Then David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem. But he put his weapons in his tent. So David takes off Goliath's head, just like he said he was going to do. And he takes the head as a trophy to Jerusalem. Now, a lot of times we read that and we think, well, that'd be a natural thing. But not at this time, no. You want to know why? Because at the time this battle happened, Jerusalem was not under Israelite control. Jerusalem was in the hands of the Jebusites. They were remnants of the old Canaanites that Israel had displaced. But for some reason, they were holed up in Jerusalem, and the Israelites couldn't get them out of there. So here's what I'm thinking is going on. David's putting that head on a stake out the gates of Jerusalem. He's saying, guys, guess what? You're next. And sure enough, when David became king, you know what one of his first actions was? He besieged Jerusalem and captured it and made it his capital. The other thing he did was he claimed Goliath's weapons and he stored them for a future need. Now, the text implies that David put them in his own tent. We find out later they actually went to the Lord's tent, what we call the tabernacle, which was the central sanctuary where Israel worshipped at that time. And in 1 Samuel 21, after Saul had to flee for his life from Saul's conspiracy to kill him, he went to the tabernacle, and guess what he asked the priest? Hey, you got any swords here? And what did the priest tell him? Remember when you brought Goliath's sword here? That's the only one we got. David said, that's the one. Give it to me. Just because you won one battle doesn't mean the war's over. As long as you seek to follow God, there's going to be other obstacles, other challenges, other giants. The enemy's going to seek an opportune moment to rise up again. Be prepared for future battles. We're told in 1 Peter, in the New Testament, chapter 5, verse 8, be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. 1,000 years later, after this battle, David's greatest descendant stood as our champion against all the dark powers of the universe, both human and spiritual. They mocked him, they belittled him, they beat him, and they nailed him to a cross. Then they buried him, and they patted themselves on the back and said, so much for the so-called Son of God. Of course, you and I know what happened 3 days later. The earth shook, the stone rolled away, and our champion came out of the tomb. As the Apostle Paul wrote in reflection on that victory, what are we to say to these things? If God is for us, who's against us? He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him over for us all, how will he not also with him freely give us all things? Who will bring a charge against God's elect? God's the one who justifies. Who's the one who condemns? Christ Jesus is he who died. Yes, rather, who was raised, who's at the right hand of God, who also intercedes for us. And what he's saying there is, hey, if anybody had a right to condemn us, it's Jesus because of what he suffered for our sake. And yet, what's he doing? He is sitting at the right hand of the Father, putting in a good word for those who've trusted him. Who will separate us from the love of Christ? Will tribulation or distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword, just as it is written, for your sake we are being put to death all day long. We were considered as sheep to be slaughtered. But in all these things we overwhelmingly conquer through him who loved us. God has provided us a champion that not even death itself could defeat. And when we're united with him in faith, you can face any giant that comes across your path without fear, knowing you're not in that battle alone.
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.